Welcome to The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Philip McKenzie. I'm an anthropologist strategist with a focus on culture and humanity-centered design. I'm Brooklyn-born and Brooklyn-made. Every week, I will bring you guests from a wide variety of backgrounds who, despite their different areas of expertise, share traits in common. They aim high, push boundaries, and make things happen. Their experiences drive insights. On today's episode of The Deep Dive, I'm joined by Dan Hill. Dan is a designer, urbanist, etc. I love the use of etc. in his part of the title. And he's director of Melbourne School of Design, the graduate school in the Faculty of Architecture, Building and Planning at the University of Melbourne in Australia. So I'm actually talking to Dan as he exists in the future, to which he assures me everything is still okay. So I feel good going into the rest of this conversation. And I want to welcome Dan to The Deep Dive. How are you, my friend?
I'm very, very well. Thank you for having me. It's really good to be here. Like I was just saying before, I'm a big fan of the show, so it's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, thank you so much. I love compliments and applause. So whenever those are offered, I'm more than happy to take them. And, you know, I've wanted to have this conversation for a while. You're someone that I've followed and read a lot of your work and really just interested in how you see things, think about things, and put them all together. As I said a little bit off air, this is going to be a little bit of a hodgepodge, right? Mm-hmm. Which I think is the highest compliment to pay, because there's so much in the way and how your thoughts kind of overlap in what I find to be very interesting. So, you know, preamble aside, I want to talk a little bit about space, Yes, not the
NASA, Elon Musk-y kind of sense. I hope not.
No, absolutely not. Like, since you listen to the show, you know very well that anything mentioning Elon Musk will merely be just derision.
No, exactly. No, the screen went black as soon as I said it. Don't worry.
Yeah. Exactly. He's only someone to be held up, to be made fun of. Not to be totally agree.
Like,
you know, revered in any way. But nonetheless, putting Musk all the way aside, space in the way we think about physical geographies, both tangible and intangible, because architecture, you know, in a thousand years ago, I was an architecture major in high school, which, you know, kind of sounds like if people are fans of, you know, Married with Children, when Al Bundy would be like, I scored four touchdowns in high school, right? Yeah. But I am proud.
I have to say, what you did in high school, just to be super clear, is more architectural training than I've had. And I now find myself running like a master's degree in architecture. So just to, you know, I did not train in architecture, but I, some of my best friends are architects, as they say.
There you go.
You know, I've kind of, I've been around architecture, so now I kind of smell of architecture a bit, if you know what I mean. And so, but yeah, no, I've never studied it, but now I end up teaching it, which is, there you go, that's a hodgepodge, isn't it?
And that's fascinating,
yeah.
Right? Because I studied it at a engineering and technical school here in New York, where it was like very serious. Like, this is like drafting, AutoCAD, like the whole nine yards, which gave me enough to know I don't want to do this when I go to college, right? So, but I love physical space, right? And I think when people think about architecture, they think about the building of things, right? But I think what's interesting is that you're designing space for humans, which also is an absence of space in a way, right? Like, rooms are not just filled with stuff, right?
Increasingly so, non-humans as well, I would say, just to sort of pick up on that one. It's kind of, space is obviously shared by everything, and it's made of everything, as in it's made of stuff, and as you said, it's also the absence of things. But to make an absence, you have to sort of carve that out, usually in some way, if you're an architect anyway. So, we're now working with our students here, and many in the industry are thinking about this as well in practice. But downstairs in our lab, we have some PhD students that are figuring out, how do we make architecture for owls or insects? You know, like what is that? because it's not necessarily just the habitat that they might think of. How do you make a hollow for an owl in a building, for instance? Is that a good idea? Is that a bad idea? Like, how would that work technically? So not just a hollow in a tree where you're used to thinking of an owl's habitat being, but can we also make things that are as beneficial to other living things as they are to humans? Or, you know, what might a shelter for a bunch of insects be? If those, for instance, in Australia, the bees, I only found this about 6 months ago. I've been living in Australia for years, but the native bees here don't sting, which is kind of amazing.
That is actually pretty interesting, because I think that's the only thing in Australia that won't kill you.
No, exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Everything else is dangerous. I mean, you know, SUVs are the most dangerous thing about Australia, but yeah, all the fauna and some of the trees will kill you as well. But yeah, bees don't sting. But of course, they've been, because of colonialism, you know, in a horrible way, those native bees are also suffering due to introduced species, invasive species of other bees. So we're trying to think, well, how do we create an environment that protects the native bees in particular? Because they're not protected by anything else around them at this point, including us. So anyway, sorry to sidetrack you there, but it's like...
No.
I think your question of space is really good, because you started in that very fluid, open way. And I was just sort of, let's make it even more fluid and open. And it's not just designing for humans.
Yeah, but that's the point. And it's funny that you, funny in a kind of a tragic way, but like New York just experienced a devastating loss at the time that we are recording this, which is Flacco the owl. So I don't know if this story made international news, but
not with me yet. I'm sure we'll get it on a ship will turn up with some... newspaper on it from
and you mentioned owls, right? So that's why it instantly leapt to mind. But it did just happen just last week as of the time that we're recording this in the Central Park Zoo. So if anybody's ever watched Madagascar, there is a Central Park Zoo, and there was a rare Eurasian owl named Flacco who was released, right? Like somebody broke into the zoo and released him from his habitat. And so Flacco has been loose in New York City for the past, call it 4 to 6 months. Wow. And tragically recently died, right?
Oh, no.
Yeah. But he was like this folk hero.
Yeah.
As, you know, freed himself from bondage and was seemingly thriving in New York City, right? There were all these like sightings of him, and people would hear him, and you know, he was a folk hero. He's a New York folk hero. He's like Derek Jeter, but for owls.
I was going to say, it's like when people see Keanu Reeves on the subway or something.
Exactly. Flacco. But the point you make about the physicality of the spaces that we live in, particularly from an urban environment, is that he died because of a bird strike. He hit a building.
Yeah.
And apparently this happens to the tune of well over 100,000 birds a year are purported to die in New York City due to bird strike. And there's another element that they also feel that perhaps, you know, he ingested a rat with poison that threw off some of his like internal radar, hence the bird strike, right? So there's a man-made element woven throughout this story as we're talking about physical space.
Completely. I mean, it also makes me think of several of your previous guests, but Alicia Guerrero, who we were talking about the other day, like complexity scientist, and just thinking about that as a very good depiction of, you know, sort of unpredictable feedback loops of why was the rat there? Because of humans, you know, probably waste coming out the back of a restaurant, creating a kind of an area for rats that then the owl interacts with in some way and then flies into a building. I mean, there's just so many impossible kind of leaps of causation going on there. That's full on. I mean, that number for birds globally is nuts in terms of the numbers that are dying every year. It's billions. So it's in the billions, and it's mainly glass buildings and cats. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, like domestic cats, because domestic cats obviously are in way more numbers than they would have been in a sort of pre-human habitat or a habitat without our kind of domesticity. But yeah, and so skyscrapers and things, which New York has a lot of, they're just death traps. But there are some architects looking at that as well. I think Jeannie Gang, who's a Chicago-based architect, has been designing some buildings recently that have different facades on them that are basically a warning to birds. They trigger the birds' optical systems in different ways. So they they don't fly into them. And this is kind of, you'd think we would have figured this out a long time ago, but it's really recent. I mean, these buildings are just off the drawing board. I think some of them now exist.
And you know, I think we're still trying to figure out so much, right? And these disciplines that like we're engaged in, you know, we're kind of talking about architecture a little bit. I find architecture so philosophically interesting because it's often used as an example of humans' dominance over the larger globe and environment that we inhabit. Like, oh, we build things, right? Like, look at these things that we could, these monuments, right? To our engineering, our intelligence, as compared to, from most people's perspective, the other species that inhabit the planet, right? That don't technically build things, right? And I've found that obviously if one kind of looks at the natural world, that's really not true. Like other species also build.
Yep.
So from your perspective as someone not classically trained as an architect, which is an asset, right? Dealing in a school of architecture and design, like how do you incorporate or do you incorporate these sorts of ideas that in a way chip away at that idea of human dominance through this discipline of architecture?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's a massive question and challenge now because, yeah, and I'm also interested in what, going back to asking you what drew you to architecture, because maybe I'll start there in a way. You can have a think about that while I'm answering this. But my first degree was a computer science, actually. So I had this kind of technical background and gives you an understanding of systems. But the things that I found most interesting on it were how people interacted with technology. So that was the, you know, the bits of the course I was good at, and I was terrible at coding and programming and stuff like that. I kind of snuck through, but the things that I found interesting were like modules called Automation and Society or Computers and Public Policy. You know, this was like in the late 80s, early 90s. So immediately I was kind of drawn by sort of what's not the thing itself, the computer in this case, but like what's it doing to us and what are we doing to it and what's the impact of that? Like what's the outcome? And then I did a master's degree in urban sociology, really, which was looking at Manchester in the north of England, where I was living, grew up in the north of England, in sort of post-industrial cities, a bit like the equivalent of Detroit and I guess Philadelphia, you know, those sort of steel cities, manufacturing towns, and then looking at the way that they were developing. And some of that's been driven by technologies, of course, like automation, but a lot of it was also economic and social change, you know, deliberately, as with Detroit, you know, sort of shifting what those cities were about by shifting the industry and leaving a kind of, you know, like when the water draws back on a beach and it just leaves all the flotsam and jetsam there. And that's kind of what the cities felt like, as with Detroit. So I was always kind of interested in what is this about? You know, like what are we doing here? What's this for? Not in a really, I hope anyway, not kind of instrumental way, as in, oh, if only we do this, then we'll do this. You know, I was already thinking then, I suppose, about before I knew the words, like complexity, but that's what drew me to it. And so the same with architecture, you know, what I'm trying to get at here is the point of architecture isn't to make a building, you know, like the answer to every question can't be a building by definition. When you go and see a doctor, it's not like immediately let's do surgery, right? You know, it's like, how are you sleeping?
Not with our insurance.
Well, no, exactly. You know, sort of, and you're not interested, they're not interested. But, you know, you're sort of, how are you sleeping? Is everything okay? What are you, you know, ideally they're asking things like that, a more holistic approach. Let's say, what are you eating? Do you exercise much? You know, like, where's the pain? And you're sort of probing around, trying to sort of see how this thing fits together. And then say, okay, well, let's try some stretches. Or maybe I do give you some painkillers or some anti-inflammatory pill or something, you know. Or maybe we do surgery, but like, you know what I mean? There's this diagnosis and understanding what a friend of mine, Marco Steinberg, calls the architecture of the problem. So what's the thing here we're looking at? How does it fit together? You know, what is it connected to as best as we can understand it? And maybe let's ask the right question. And this is what I think design, and I mean, designer more broadly, you know, all of my career, first half I spent working on website design and mainly in the music industry, and then at the BBC, designing websites. And then I did cities, returning to cities for the second half of my career thus far, right? Cities and buildings and places and neighborhoods and stuff. But in both of those, I think what design is doing at its best is not coming up with a kind of prescribed solution that it already has in mind, but but trying to frame the right question in the first place. Do we need to build anything at all? And this is where I think architecture can be incredibly powerful, because it has a set of kind of diagnostic skills and capabilities. Architects are pretty good at relational thinkers. You know, if you think, even if you do make a building, you're usually talking to the client, but also the builder, the contractors, the material suppliers. You're looking at the site, the place, the neighborhood, the community. You're talking with them as well. And you're sort of like running around between all of these people and trying to convince them that this project is a good idea. And that takes a lot of this kind of relational capability. You're moving between materials and nature, as you said earlier, and science, but you're also doing craft and art. And, you know, you're holding a meeting with a community group. That's not really a science context. Sometimes it is, but like often it can be much more social, interpersonal skills required. So all of that stuff is swimming around. And what I'm trying to, I suppose we, many of us here, are trying to say is that, again, I think Lacaton and Vassal, the French architects who won the Pritzker Prize a few years ago, sort of put this best. You know, they said that they were commissioned to do a revamp of a park in a small French town, like a courtyard sort of-ish park or plaza between some buildings. And they looked at it and studied it carefully and spoke to people. And they said, you know what? It's fine. It doesn't need... It doesn't need a building, and it doesn't need any major earthworks or anything. And the diagnosis was, in a way, it's basically fine. You just need to change the maintenance of the trees, more or less. Maybe you might want to, you know, put out some deck chairs or something. So the answer doesn't have to be a building. It comes back to framing the questions in the right way, trying to flush them out of the context. And that's that kind of diagnostic thing. And then, again, trying to understand the architecture of the problem. But why is that because of this? Or is it because of that? You know, it's not. And then you can come up with some, you know, the thing that design does is not just analysis. It's not just, well, that's happening because of this, you know, full stop. That's what analysts do. But there's a designer's job is also a little bit to do synthesis, which is come up with something, you know, like, well, okay, we've been analyzed the situation. Maybe it could be like this or like this or like this or like this. You know, we can sketch that out. We have prototypes, we have models, we have ways of doing that. But that's that kind of bouncing backwards and forwards, always searching around and trying to find, are we sure we're asking the right question here? This is why designers can be very frustrating sometimes. But are we really thought about this carefully before we try and commit to doing what's really capital intensive, material intensive thing like making a building? You know, it's just a real slog making a building. And so do it very carefully, I guess I'm saying.
There's a lot to kind of go into there. And I want to start with the framing of the question. Mm. Because I think when, like, thoughtful people, like I'm including you in that thoughtful people category, we'll say like, oh, you know, we have to think deeply about the problem. And to other thoughtful people, including myself in that equation, right? that sounds like, oh yeah, of course, right? But as a practitioner, I find that getting people to really take the time and step back and like ask questions is a little bit more difficult than what was just described. And I'm saying that as someone who has spent time in a variety of different industries, but even just using creative briefs as an example, right? They're usually, you know, or an RFP is usually written to get to a point, right? Like they've already determined,
yeah,
this is our challenge. Here's the RFP. We're looking for this. Right. And I've looked at some of those documents and I'm like, are you sure that's a problem? Like I don't know enough to say whether that's the problem or not. Right. But you can't respond with like, give me more info. Right. Like that's typically not going to get you to the bid process. So I'm curious in your mind, like, how do you get to the point where all the parties involved and then this could be taken out of an architectural context, because I think it's a problem that exists in a variety of different disciplines and industries, and get them to think about asking better questions, framing problems in ways that are more cohesive. Like how does that work in beyond the theory of it?
Again, it's a great question. And this is the kind of subject of my last 10, 15 years of my own inquiry, you know, and so I don't think there's an easy answer to that. I think it's a constant process of discovery in itself. But it's a couple of things. One is that I completely agree, and anybody listening that's in that kind of mode will probably recognize what you said completely. Those RFPs or briefs are chock full of assumptions. They're kind of, again, they sort of, the client usually has in mind the solution and they kind of just want you to execute it more or less, even though it doesn't say that. They, you know, everything about it is structured in that way. And you're also asked when you then pitch or give a proposal back or whatever it is. And this happens, by the way, in policymaking, creative practice, design and architecture, almost all walks of life. When you're asked to then pitch back, you're also got to say, and this is how much it's going to cost, and this is when I'm going to get it done by, and this is how much material I'm going to use if it's material intensive. You know, like all of those things you have to commit to before you started somehow, and which is really absurd when you're dealing with anything complex, which is most things. You know, and it's just sort of, that was really nagging away a bunch of us when in the late 2000s or so, so about 2008-09, I've been working in Australia for this big engineering company called Arup in Sydney, a great company, do lots of things. And one way or another, I'd got involved with some folk in Helsinki in Finland, and I ended up going to join them. And that's what we started looking at. We started calling it strategic design, not because it was a good name, because it's a terrible name. It's got strategy and design in it. But it's like... It was more. Let's try to swim upstream, as you were saying. How do we not just get commissioned as designers to design a chair or a website or a building? Because we know that these things are all implicated in actually the major challenges of our time, whether it's climate action or public health or social justice. You know, any one of these challenges are played out through the way that we make things like buildings and cities and neighborhoods and stuff like that. But if you're an architect getting called in to design, I don't know, a community center or a church or a recording studio, and they've already framed the brief and you're kind of stuck within the red line on that. And again, you've got to say it's going to be, you know, $2 million and it's going to be done by Tuesday. How do you then connect that to like climate crisis? You know, it's just like everything you're doing is implicated in it, but you cannot swim back upstream. And in doing away what I said, these French architects Lacaton and Bassel said, you know, they were very interesting and brave because they said you don't need anything at all. The park is fine. You know, that's highly unusual, right? Almost turning down the job.
Also, you know, I'm not expert on them, but if you're winning a Pritzker Prize, you're accomplished, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, I mean, they won that, I think, just after that. But they were in their, I would guess, in their late 50s, you know, like the, so yeah, they were significant enough to be able to have the guts to say,
yeah, to turn something down.
What you think. Yeah, exactly. And actually,
sometimes,
you know,
sometimes you ain't in a position to turn anything down.
I know. And if you're super smart, you get paid for doing nothing.
Yeah.
But like, then, not that they did nothing, they had the right reference. But so we ended up setting up this thing called Helsinki Design Lab within something called the Finnish Innovation Fund, which is, I can talk about, it's a very interesting thing. It's a publicly owned fund that whose job is to think about the future of Finland, you know, like look after the future of Finland. So it's, not many countries have such a thing, and it's typically Finnish to do that, irritatingly Finnish in a very good way, right? And so we were then able to sort of look at, well, how do we try and position ourselves as designers kind of more on the client side in that sense, or with the client here, or for questions where there is no client? I mean, climate breakdown, there is no one client, you know, it's all of us. Yeah. We're all implicated. This is one of the problems, obviously. We can't just go to, and maybe you could say we could just go to Exxon, but in reality, it's not even just Exxon, you know, it's everything else. And so
it's a lot of different characters play the role.
There's a lot of
that.
Moving pieces. So you can't really just go to the client and just pitch. So we were saying, let's try and position ourselves as best we can, where we can start doing projects where we're exploring these much wider questions. And within that, we'll look at things like social justice and climate action and so on. But we'll explore multiple formats, different ways of working. We'll look at what I then started calling the dark matter, which I know Indy is a, you know, good friend of yours and big friend of mine as well. So I wrote this book called Dark Matter and Trojan Horses around that time, just trying to understand. We might look at the matter, like a church or a chair or a car or something, and what you can't see is all of the stuff that makes that happen or stops that happening in a different way. Like when you look at the building, you can't see the building code unless you're an architect, but you know, you're staring at the manifestation of the code, basically. You can go up and like knock your hand on the the front door, and that's the matter. It's produced by regulations, building codes, organizational cultures, bureaucracies, you know, all of those things you can't see at all, but they affect what comes out the other end. And we were kind of saying, well, actually, maybe we should focus on that, not the church end of the problem or the recording studio end of the problem. Like, that's other designers are probably better at that as well, to be fair. We're probably better placed, like, trying to swim upstream and say, what if, you know, one of the projects we did was, rather than just make a building to demonstrate a new way of making buildings, which we were trying to do, we discovered halfway through that process that we couldn't make it. We wanted to make it in mass timber, like wood, like a tall building made out of wood. We couldn't make it because the building code said you can't do that. But the building code just hadn't been updated from the, you know, the 80s in this sense. And in the old days, wooden buildings would burn down. So you wouldn't be allowed to make a good tall building, you know, out of wood because it would burn down. Totally logical. But then this new timber technology comes along, which doesn't burn. You compress it in a factory. It's all wood, but it's just like super dense plywood. So just chars, you know, and it locks up the carbon. It's beautiful. And it comes from Finnish forests. And there's a bazillion reasons why this timber was a good idea, but the code said no. So rather than just walk away, and usually what happens then, if you're an architect and you've got a building to deliver, is you say, okay, we'll just do concrete then, you know, bring it on, like, fine. We started in wood, but, you know, it happens a million times a year in this industry. But we managed to get our lawyers in our agency to talk to the Building Code of Finland's lawyers and say, what if we change the code, the building code, because this technology looks like it's been tested, it's viable. And then in changing the code, you don't just make one building happen, you enable multiple future buildings to happen, obviously. The code is the code that writes the city. And we don't usually think of building codes like you think of it as a stuffy old regulation, like on bits of paper. But if you think of a code in the more generative sense, it's the code that writes the city, or not. You know, it says how tall buildings can be, what they can be made of, setbacks and stuff like that. So that was a real breakthrough.
It gives you the limits and stipulations under which you can
totally
operate.
Exactly. And it's an enabler, or it's a, yeah. So we were trying to kind of get to say that position of, and I don't want that to sound hubristic or anything, because we were very conscious that designers often can be seen as arrogant, and they are. And so we're very clear to say our job is to, again, like, frame better questions and figure out, is this the building or the code? Or is this, you know, we can talk later about maybe street food or something, but I've gone on a bit with this answer, but like, is this a question of food culture or regulations around hygiene? Or is this about where do we put street food trucks, or do we not have them at all? And all of those things are options, questions, really. And that's what we made our focus.
And, you know, I love the story that you shared, because it allows us to talk about gaps and cracks, which is something else that has come up in your work, and recognizing that there's possibility within these gaps and cracks, the things that we can't see provide perhaps ways forward, right? So you can recognize, like, okay, why hasn't a building been built like this in X amount of times? There was at one point maybe a technological gap, right? Like, we couldn't do it for the reasons that you shared, safety, what have you. But now, once we can, what are the political, legislative, kind of urban planning gaps that exist? But once you open that, you know, now, like you said, it's not one building, it's many buildings. So I want to use that example, and maybe a little bit more about the Finnish fund will come up in your answer, perhaps, I'm not sure, but you can have the gaps and cracks, but if there's not, you know, my favorite word and topic, the underlying culture to be open to the kind of changes, whatever the changes might be. In this case, it was a building code change, but insert change of choice, that's another issue to kind of parse through, right? And in an environment like Finland, you know, a little bit more open-minded, and also have capital to commit to this, right? In a more capital constrained and intellectual constraint, getting through that building code could be more difficult. So this parse through that a little bit, and how you manage the gaps and the cracks along with the culture piece.
Yeah, I like this gaps and cracks thing, because what we were thinking about there is, you know, what drives a lot of Finnish culture, a lot, not all of it, but is a question of equality. And there's the profoundly positive, progressive, useful aspect of that, which is let's make this building of timber because of climate action, and it's viable for everyday folk, and we can do that. And this is a public building or like a public block. You know, there's that general sense of equality baked in, which tends that way very quickly. And then the positive side of what I was saying then in terms of changing the code is that that will make it equitable for everybody. So if you think about it, again, like in a different culture, let's just say the UK where I'm from or the US, often that culture isn't quite as clearly framed around equality, even though we tell ourselves that it is. And it's more framed around the idea of the individual breakthrough. You know, we'll have an individual who will make a genius kind of breakthrough here, right? And Finland doesn't have so many of those. It's much more of an even place. It does have there's one of the most famous architects in the world, Alvar Aalto, Finnish. But like usually the buildings are, I'd say, good to very good, you know, or maybe even average to good to very good. They're never terrible, though. You know, they're just like, they're kind of, I'm making a, not that anybody listening can see this, I'm making a horizontal line gesture with my hand. You know, it's like this kind of...
There's a straight line happening.
There's a flatness to the place. And that flatness is both a positive and a negative, and that comes from the negative in a second. But the flatness, like imagine a horizontal line, describes the kind of quality of the buildings and the built environment, the neighborhoods. They're all good. None of them are amazing. Some of them are beautiful. Like, I don't want to get this wrong way around, but they're not beautiful for the reasons of the buildings necessarily, because of what people have done to them. But there's nothing terrible there. Just like the healthcare is good, affordable, it'll cure you. It's not world leading, but no one's going to fall through the gaps in it, to your point about gaps and cracks, right? It's like the welfare safety net is so strong. You know, and there's no homeless people really, because they have a policy called it's called Housing First, which means that I'm generalizing slightly, but if you're homeless, you go to this place, which is funded by the government ultimately, and they give you a house. It's just like, yeah, then you're not homeless, right?
Which is cheaper than many alternatives.
I'm sure this has come up on your show before, because it's such a shining example. Like because basically, again, super pragmatically, in a very Finnish way, very pragmatic people, when you live in minus 30 occasionally, then you get very pragmatic, right? So they just said, it costs us more as a society in terms of healthcare and social costs and everything else, policing and so on to do with homelessness, that we'd just be better off like spending the money up front and giving them a house, because then they can pull themselves together and do what they want to do with their lives. You know, like and it's almost like no strings attached, which is kind of extraordinary. It wouldn't happen in the UK like that, I can tell. There's a kind of a meanness of spirit in the UK crossed with an individualism that would say you should pull yourself up on your own shoestrings, mate. You know,
we have that same spirit.
Exactly. Well, guess where you might have got it from. But it's like, you know, sort of, that does not scale equitably, clearly. So what you have in the US and the UK is a more like spiky culture, now making like a very funny vertical up and down thing. So you do get individual geniuses. In the UK, you get, you know, we invent punk music, or you invent hip hop, or the shining individual architects, or those brilliant individual thinkers, you know. And so you get David Bowie, and you get Vivian Westwood, you get Jay Dilla or whatever. Like, you get these geniuses breaking through, and they go pam, and they, you know, they're something. But then equally in the same countries, that same spikiness also means you have gaps and cracks, and you can fall right through the floor all the way to the bottom, and no one's going to catch you. You know, it's just as you know full well. So it's kind of the way we've organized our society to say, well, we're organized around the individual to some degree, and we expect them to like, to pursue their dream in America, or the UK version of that. And the cost of that is that we can't have a functioning welfare state, or we can't just give houses away to people, or, you know, education is going to be sometimes great, Harvard, Yale, sometimes terrible, often terrible. Finland just doesn't make those choices like that. It just says, you know what, equality is our starting point. And we're naturally not bothered if maybe we make a Jay Dilla one day, I don't know, you know. And they do, but it's not like, for them, it's more important for everybody to have a house and get fed and, yeah, you know, to have that social equity.
This is unscripted. Like, I didn't write a question about this, but this has come up before, because Finland, I'll kind of include in the Nordic model, right?
Yeah.
Like something that is discussed in many different circles, and you know, understanding, of course, that Finland, Norway, Sweden, and Denmark, I'll include Denmark, even though it's continental, you know, are unique countries in and of themselves, right? So I'm not going to do what people do about Africa and just lump them all together, right?
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
Those Nordic folk, like we talk about Africans, right? Like you know, they are distinct.
Yeah, they are.
With their own challenges. But one of the things that I've seen, and maybe it's not in Finland, I'm not an expert, but I've definitely seen it in Sweden, where there's like a swing to the right, mm-hmm. right? And I look at that as an outsider. I've been to Sweden, but what do I know, right? I just visited Stockholm and kicked it for a few days, right? Like I did nothing virtuous but drink and party. it was a wonderful time. But
exactly.
You know,
this is a highly informed view, a deep sociological analysis coming.
Highly informed view of the 4 a.m. nightlife scene in Stockholm. But from that informed decision, when I see it now from a distance and read about it, it feels like there's questioning of that sort of straight line equality, because it's now a function of, well, who deserves this relative to everyone else, right?
Yeah.
And I remember another article talking about physical space. This is not Sweden. It's an article about Denmark, which I've quite honestly, I will say, I was quite appalled about the dissolution of these communities and neighborhoods and literally like raising of these sort of building complexes. And they have a name for it that I can't remember right now. But basically the idea was, we have all these immigrants coming here. They're getting into their own communities, but we want them to be Danish. So we're going to like get rid of these buildings, get rid of these complexes, and they just got to find a place among the broader Danish community, because that's the only way they're going to become Danish, right? And I find that deeply problematic.
No, super,
on a lot of levels.
Well, like I said, it's like, I said there'd be a negative side to this line.
Here we are.
Yeah, exactly.
And we got it there.
It plays out in a kind of a more mundane way as well, as in just resistance to change. So, you know what, the building code example is a good example. It's, you know, just that happens elsewhere in other countries, obviously. But once you've kind of established like this flat line of, you know, universal welfare and education and things like that, and then the buildings or the neighborhoods have a certain kind of way of looking because that's the way it's been done in the past and it seemed to work then. Of course, change is then hard to absorb into that system, because that's why, you know, the UK and the US does produce, I think, incredible individuals creatively. We can talk about them. And somewhere like Finland, that happens less often because it doesn't value that in quite the same way. There's what, you know, it's called the Eurovianti in the Nordic region, or Jantelagen, which is really like tall poppy syndrome, as in don't stick your head above the parapet, just keep your head down, you're the same as everybody else. There's a good side to that. You're the same as everybody else is a very positive message if you get it at like a deep human level. It's a completely negative message, of course, if there's no assumption being questioned there. Like, are we the same as everybody else? Am I the same as you? You know, like then you're immediately saying, well, you can do it again very openly in a very diverse sense of society at a human level. Wonderful. But if it's oppositional and saying, well, Finns are different to Danes and we're certainly different to Ghanaians, you know, then it's, of course, completely problematic. And that does play out there. Obviously, it's been foolish to ignore that. It is a more homogenous society, generally speaking, population-wise. So it has characteristics shared with Japan in that sense. And Japan also has the same qualities of this flatness to some degree, very high standards for everybody in a sense, you know, universal healthcare, all of those things. And so it's interesting, this interplay between these kind of social good outcomes and that homogeneity. And then that's the problem. And so what we were trying to do there is say, well, so the challenge here would be, how do you absorb diversity without killing it? So that, like, without you then saying, we're going to absorb diversity by basically watering it down so it becomes nothing. So if you're from Ghana and you come to Helsinki, we expect you to suddenly turn Finnish. No, we don't. We want you to be a little less Ghanaian. No one would ever say that, of course. But like a lot of the societal codes, mores, systems are kind
sometimes of like, they do say it.
Well, sorry, yeah. They would. They wouldn't say it. Maybe you're right. Maybe that's why I'm not a politician.
But like, they definitely do be saying that shit.
So yeah, I want to. They would say, "We want you to become Finnish."
Yeah.
So yeah, they would, and because they're trying to get at this sense of, again, like the positive side. These things have worked. The negative side. We think we're better because these things have worked, you know, and therefore you need to become more like us, not the other way around. And so what we were trying to do, all of our projects in Finland at that time, and then I worked for the Swedish government before I moved to Melbourne for the last 4 years, I was working inside the Swedish government as a designer. All of those projects were about trying to introduce diversity into a homogenous system without killing it, you know, and so I think that's the trick. And I think that I find that fascinating because at least when you have a situation where you've achieved a certain steady state of some kind, you can have this conversation. You do have things like the Finnish Innovation Fund that can hire like a British person and two American guys. And our boss was a Finnish Italian American. we were the first four foreigners that had ever worked for this organization since like 1965, mm-hmm. you know, been around since then. Right. So, my colleagues Justin Cook and Brian Boyer, both brilliant, but from the US. Justin, I should give him credit. You know, he's the one that led a lot of that building code story I told you before, working with the lawyers. But we were a kind of bodies introduced into this system to create a certain amount of meaningful, useful chaos, I guess, on the basis that we wanted to explore how would you enable these common good outcomes for everybody. In a way that had a certain amount of spikiness to it as well. But the spikes inevitably will probably, you have to look at this absorbing function again. So, in again, the mundane way, this new wood technology gets absorbed into the building code. The other project we did, street food, like street food was just not happening in Helsinki in about 2011, 2012. People in Helsinki knew that street food existed. They could see it on the internet. You know, they go on holiday to Berlin and London and they see street food.
Yeah, of course.
They came back to Helsinki and it just wasn't there. And so we led projects there looking at, well, why is that? And it just turns out that street and food is caught between two different agencies, the food agency and the planning agency, basically. And the planning agency knows nothing about food, and the food agency knows nothing about street, really, just because of the past. And so there was literally like a gap, to your point, where the law should be saying you can have street food. So we did project after project, basically, doing questions about that, working with local activists there who led these amazing street food kind of pop-ups, totally illegally in a way, as in they didn't have a license to do it. But they broke through very quickly, just through sheer force of numbers and brilliance. And one lovely thing about that I saw on this point was that you started getting all these pop-ups all over the city, again, just working at scale, a kind of a street food festival. And I realized that in the street next to me where I lived in Helsinki, was an Argentinian woman because they were selling food from their kitchens directly to the street as part of this festival. And they were making empanadas. And there was a woman dressed, standing in the street outside the window, dressed as an empanada to advertise. Like she was like fully like, you know, like a 5 foot tall empanada walking around the street. Advertising this thing. Now, I didn't know there was an Argentinian woman living on that street at all. You know, I had no idea. Yeah. And I'd never seen an empanada in Helsinki, you know, and so food was a way of revealing the diversity in a way that was actually adding to the city's richness. And it was so clearly good. It was so popular that the city basically had to change multiple laws and, you know, like the police had to back off. I mean, that was a problem. They just didn't know what to do about it. Right? So that's an example of like, again, a very sort of everyday example, but how do you absorb diversity into a system without losing some of the qualities of the system, like equality that go along with that? You want everything to be equal for everybody at a basic level. And then how do you have difference within that? Classic challenge, obviously. And what's happening in those Nordic countries now, just to quickly mention that, is that there is a swing to the right at the national government level in Sweden. I think it'll swing back, to be honest. And just to be super clear, the swing to the right is less than in the UK or the US is usually set. You know what I mean? Or Australia, where I am now, right? So it's like within reasons, within a bound. And the real power, the thing to watch, the Danish stuff's a good example, but that's really problematic because the real power in the Nordic countries is at the local city level. You pay your income tax to the city and not to the national government. The national government sort of does foreign policy, the military, you know, like things.
But
like
the municipalities are where the power is.
Exactly. And they deliver healthcare, education, like, you know, housing, everyday stuff, like all of that stuff set locally. They're very, very powerful. And that if they start going to the right, then there's an issue. But because those city governments are far more in touch with people on the ground, usually they see the everyday diversity of places like Stockholm, actually. They tend not to go rightwards. They tend not to go super left either. They just sort of hover around the center left. You know, if you were like putting them on a political spectrum globally, center left is where they'd end up. So there are worrying signs there for sure. And there'll be more challenges because of climate migration, because that will be a good place to head.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
That'll be an interesting challenge. But I reckon there's enough in the kind of DNA there, if they work it through, that is really would be incredibly positive, because they could retain the equality setting and then think, how do we introduce diversity without killing it? I mean, that would be an amazing breakthrough.
You know, it's funny when I think about, it's not the only way I think about diversity, but you know, when you make the point about how culture absorbs and you have these spikes and things are introduced into a system, you know, you had a great example with the food truck. I tend to think about food generally in the sense that I love supermarkets. Like everywhere I go, even if I'm just traveling domestically in the United States, but especially if I'm overseas, I visit local supermarkets, right? Because I just want to see how they're laid out, how wide the aisles are, the lighting, how they advertise, everything about it just really fascinates me. I know that's a really weird thing to be interested in.
What I've
noticed here is, I'm going to focus on one particular thing, but it's like sriracha. Mm-hmm. You know, like sriracha was not a thing, call it 10, 15 years ago, right? Like it was for communities who either really liked Asian food and was used to different chilies and different types of things, and communities who like that. But you were not going into Whole Foods, right? And finding like eight different types of srirachas on the menu, yeah, right?
Exactly.
Or on the
sumac
on the
or something.
Yeah. But now it's everywhere, right? Like I go through the supermarket and I see all these variety of not just sriracha, but different sauces and pick ways to flavor food. And I'm like, there's a reason for that, right? Like as folks come and they introduce new things, new palates, things change, right? Yeah. And what no one's just like, oh, I need to have that on my burger, right? Like burgers were like ketchup and maybe a ketchup mayonnaise mix. Now it's like, oh, I need a chipotle aioli. I need a sriracha mayo. Like I need all these different
exactly.
things. So net, I think in a very benign example, absorption happens in a way where people forget what it was like before this thing even existed, right? Like,
yeah.
And that kind of brings me to another point. I'm keeping an eye on time here, but I want to talk about slowing down, right? Like another kind of element to your work that has kind of popped up, because I think culture seems to move very fast, but in my mind anyway, I think it actually moves quite slowly, these kind of changes, because we have these absorptions. So I want to give you an opportunity to kind of talk about this notion of slowing down, because I think that the idea of slowing down can be quite radical in a world that seems to ask us to do the opposite.
No, I mean, it's a theme for me, as you know. And it follows from your, I think I really like your reservation on sriracha. And, you know, someone who grew up in Sheffield in the north of England in the 1980s, I think mayonnaise was exotic there. You know, it's just sort of like it was, you know, I didn't eat sushi until I was like 28 or something, you know, just sort of, you know, whereas my kids have been eating sushi since they were born, more or less. So I think food is really interesting, because food is precisely a culture. It's why, again, shout out to my colleague Brian Boyer, who I worked with in Helsinki many times since. He's at the University of Michigan now, who really, I think, got me thinking about food as a way of doing projects, because it is culture, infrastructure, science, like biology, You know, it's, you could, I sometimes think I could reorganize my entire design school around food. You know, you can like teach almost anything through food. It's global flows, it's local things, it's history, it's future, it's stuff in the lab,
supply
it's stuff
chain,
10,000 years ago. Exactly. Know. It's all in there, and you've got to do it like three times a day, you know, thereabouts. Everybody has to do it.
At least. So it's, more, exactly. More if you're a snacker.
So you've got this kind of amazing thing around you all the time as a kind of a substrate to work with. So that's hence the street food project was really powerful, because it was really a project about public space and who decides what the street is for, right? And that was the kind of question in our mind. It's like the streets were very homogenous. Who decided that? And what reasons? Again, the architecture of the problem. And it came back to, well, we don't want street trees because it snows for 3 months of the year and we need to get snow clearers through. And it's just a hassle if there's a tree in the way. And it's like, well, that is not a really good reason to not have a tree. Like, we can figure that out some other way because the tree is far more beneficial ultimately. But who decided? So who decided we couldn't have street food? Well, no one really. It was just like a gap or a crack, as you say, in the policy framework. And then having kind of cultivated some prototypes. And it's hard to ignore something called Restaurant Day, which is what popped out of that, not by us, but by other people, which spread to like 40 countries. Like, the city could not ignore this street food festival they'd accidentally created by taking their hand off the tiller on the policy stuff. So coming to your point on slowdown, like, what I'm interested in then is then kind of layers of change within a society, and some of them move slowly and some of them move quickly, as you said, and music, for instance, you know, a big shared of interest of both of us, is another good example of a kind of a cultural substrate that can move very, very quickly at times. You know, there are subgenres that can pop up within like 2 days and then disappear again within 2 weeks. And equally, people still listen to Beethoven. You know, it's like, or before that, you know, like, these people still listen to stuff from, frankly, like probably 20,000 years ago, right? And so you get all of these things running similarly through a society, and it's a carrier mechanism for culture. It's profoundly useful as a way of bringing people together, also kind of differentiating yourself, you know, but in a largely non-harmful way. So food and music are kind of interesting in that respect. And they come to this point then about how things move quickly or slowly. And there's a thing we use in strategic design, which goes back to a diagram that a guy called Frank Duffy did in the 1970s called Layers of Change in a Building. And he just did this quick sketch of a typical sort of almost like archetypal building, as if like a kid would draw it with a pitch roof and so on. And he said, you know, the building is moving at different speeds, actually. We think it's a static thing, but of course it's moving. So like the stuff where I put my desk or where your chair is, you know, you can move that now. I can slide back my chair like this. Nothing to stop me, right? You know, so that can move very fluidly. I can shift the table out. The structure of the building, like this concrete column behind me, now that's probably ideally not going to move for about 80 years or so. You know, maybe 40 years, maybe 80 years, maybe 200 years. Ideally, it would stay there a long time. The drop ceiling, you know, we might change that every 10, 20 years because the air conditioning filter unit changes. So the whole building, he described it as kind of shearing layers. It's kind of like constantly like working itself apart. And so you can have a building which has got, you know, bricks from 400 years ago in England. And within that, you can install Wi-Fi and a projector. You know, it's like, so it's kind of, you've got these speeds going all at the same time. It immediately breaks open your thinking about how things move, or how things, Stuart Brand then wrote a book based on that idea called How Buildings Learn, which was about these kind of layers and the information they pass to each other.
That book is literally sitting on my desk, like, all the time. Like,
yeah, well, exactly. Mine's to my right, a foot over there. But it's kind of, you know, there's problems. There we go. Anyway.
Yep.
There's problems with this book.
I have an old beat up hardcover.
Yeah, right. You know, this book was banned in Britain for a few years. It wasn't allowed because Richard Rogers, who was a great architect, I think, by the way, and a nice man, tried to stop its publication because it was very mean about one of the Richard Rogers buildings in the city of London, the Lloyd's building. So there was a legal suit about it. This was like contraband, you know? You had to go to the States to buy it.
The architectural version of the Anarchist Handbook, right?
Yeah, exactly. So that principle then, Brand also then did a subsequent diagram, which has like, I think it's got like nature as the slowest moving layer. He has then culture is quite a slow moving layer. And then governance, I think, and then I'm trying to remember this. Governance, then infrastructure, then fashion. And fashion is the fastest moving layer. I find it a bit weird, actually. I would shuffle those things around because I think culture can move quickly, culture can move slowly. To your point about sriracha, you know, maybe that's a fashion. But actually, I think with food, fashions do come, but they tend to like bed in, you know. And so sushi was a fashion, then is just every day. So hip-hop was a thing that was almost avant-garde in 1979, then is almost the soundtrack to everybody's life, you know. And so they kind of, it moves up and down, I think, it's in a more complex way than its diagram imagines. So anyway,
it's now ubiquitous.
Exactly. Problematically sometimes. But there's this like, so this question of slowing down is kind of framed by that to begin with. It's like, what's happening? What I'm interested in is what's happening in our culture, our infrastructure, our governance, and what speed is it moving, and what's driving those things. And so, the real thing I want to, you know, maybe we're bringing it together is the idea that we've been driven by a certain kind of growth for the last 200 years or so, and a rapid growth. This period is called the rapid acceleration. Sometimes people put it at 150 years back. Sometimes people put it at post-war, post-Second World War, you know. So that kind of incessant drive, you could argue you could start a colonialization from the 1500s onwards, you know, like, but either way, that all of that pattern of activity based around constant expansion, constant growth, and then feeding a machine to feed itself, we know has just hit hard limits. And well, we knew that in 1972 when they wrote the limits to growth, but we really know it now because, like, Canada's on fire, you know, and things like that. So there's every reason now to think differently about that pattern of growth. I've just read two books on degrowth. I'm not sure I'm in that camp, but I do think there's a slow growth. There's a healthy growth or an organic growth, like a forest grows, but it doesn't grow in a way that trashes everything else around it. You know, if you have a kid, you want them to grow because it would be pretty weird if everybody stayed 1 foot tall, but you don't want them to be 9 foot tall, you know, or maybe you do, but you don't, you know, at some point the growth evens out and you find a steady state, and ideally you don't want them to be, you know, thousands of pounds in weight. So there's a growth kind of, there's a different kind of growth there. You know what I mean?
And jumping in there real quick.
Yeah.
Like thinking about that, whether it's the terminology and understanding and respecting these terminologies are relevant. You know, I've had folks on the show that talk about degrowth specifically. So
yeah, of course. Yeah.
I don't want to like give kind of a short dismissive thing that it's all the same. All of these things have nuance to them, but the notion of slowing down and also being non-extractive, I think is one of the things that is important. Yeah. So I want to introduce that idea, like, are those terms necessarily related to one another?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, when you look at those curves of population growth, GDP growth, which is a particular kind of growth based on obviously the growth for its own sake, essentially, and extraction growth, they're all completely in line with each other. You know, they sort of hug each other in an awkward embrace. So what's interesting there is two of those have to change. And that will change the third, as in population growth is slowing down anyway for reasons we can talk about in a minute. Extraction has to stop because other reasons you know full well. So that asks us the deep question about the third one, which is this notion of economic growth or GDP growth, which has been tied to those other two, maybe causally in causing one, maybe driven by the other. You know, they're in a like weird symbiotic kind of dance with each other. So, yeah, it is linked to both of these kind of different ideas. There's two great books called almost exactly the same title, Slow Down and Slow Down. Slow Down is written by an English, he's an Oxford University geography professor. The book is far more accessible than those words sound, just to be clear. So he's called Danny Dorling. He's an interesting guy. He wrote it in 2020, came out about a month before COVID. I bet he's wishing he'd waited 6 months like everybody did, because he would have had a very good addendum to the book. But anyway, that is about the population slowdown, really. He's a demographer, so he's just looking at why the population slowdown is happening so profoundly in some countries already, like Japan, where you're looking at something like 45% of the households in the country, or 40% being empty by about 2038. So almost half of the houses in the country being empty within the next 15, 20 years, which is an extraordinary thing to imagine for a country which is like third biggest economy in the world or whatever. Yeah, 120 million people, you know, so you're also looking at China going from 1.3 or 1.4 billion down to about 750 million by the end of the century. Italy, Thailand, et cetera, Poland, you know, same, halving their population base. So his book starts with that. And to be super clear, he gets very quickly onto this is not necessarily a bad thing, which is kind of interesting because whenever it's framed like that, and you know, if you see it in the New York Times, it's usually China's population crisis, Japan's population crisis, even the states, you know, the population curve is still going up, but it's leveling out big time, and it's usually described as a crisis.
Well, I've seen to jump in real quick that I don't remember where I saw this, so some of the numbers might be a little bit wrong, but I feel like pretty recently I saw a headline that the growth that the United States has seen in the past either 5 years or a decade has been through immigration.
Yeah, totally.
It's not through natural birth rates.
No, exactly. Because basically in countries where you get, and this is Dorling's point, he says the reason why we shouldn't think of this as a bad twofold. One, he says, and you can quibble with this, like, and please do, but like he says it's a sign of social progress. Like when women have control over their reproductive rights, they have fewer kids. If they have education, good childcare, healthcare, they have fewer kids. You know, my granddad was one of 14 kids. And people, you know, people had big families then because kids died. You know, they were in the north of England. They went off to sea. They sometimes didn't come back. So you basically spread your bets. It's pretty horrible. And you'd have 14 kids. And then my dad was one of three. And then I have two. You know, it's just like, this is the pattern. And so that's happened in lots of different places. It's not even to do with whether it's, you know, so-called developed, overdeveloped, developing, whatever. It's just like, because there are lots of variations there. It's just if women have control of their bodies and they have options, you tend to level out. Maybe you have one kid, maybe you have two, maybe you have three, but on average that ends up about 1.5 or 1.6 or whatever. And that's not a replacement birth rate. So he says that's a good thing in lots of ways because it means that a society has got to a certain point where women are not having to pop out kids the whole time. That's a good thing. And he says the second thing is that this could be a way, along with lots of other things, of pulling our extraction net down. Now, to be really clear, he's very careful, as am I, to always say, well, it's not like everybody has to have no kids to pull our extraction down. Like, we can do that numerous ways, and we can't load it on birth rate. And equally, of course, all of the extraction, like 92% of it, is in a handful of countries, actually, and have been responsible for that. So when we're talking, just to be super clear, you know, so some people have to work harder than others now. And it's the rich countries, it's the States, it's the UK, it's Australia, it's Canada. It's like, we're the ones that have to actually try a lot harder. Just so people are clear when I'm talking about birth rate, because it can get, there's a very nasty political route it goes down, as you know.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And it's funny when talking, you know, kind of taking us back to the rise of the right in some of these Nordic Scandinavian countries, and you see it everywhere. A lot of far-right rhetoric is very much in reproductive and birth theories, right? Like, yeah. You know, horrible. protecting the race, having more kids, and you see it here. Like, it's very exactly. Stealthily done with a lot of, like, I talk about this all the time, a lot of, like, seemingly benign television shows that are very much on, like, nuclear family, many kids, very like white faces in Utah kind of vibe. Yeah. You're like, what's happening?
No, seriously, it's hateful bullshit, to put it plainly. And it's really problematic. So we've got to be very careful when we're talking about birth rates, obviously. But if what Dorling's point is that if you see it as a sign of social progress, you can see it as a sign of social progress.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
autonomy and women having more and more freedom of whatever choices they choose to make, family
exactly,
or otherwise.
Exactly.
I'm pro that camp.
Exactly. So it's the most foundational thing. And as a result, that changes the dynamic, because it means you don't have an economy like based, you know, if I think about housing, which is something I think about a lot in my job, it means you have enough houses already. You know, so, and we actually have more than enough houses. There's a million empty homes in Australia right now, you know, many more than there are homeless people, actually. So like,
there's a lot of empty homes in New York too.
Totally. But all you will hear in all of our countries, actually, is we have a housing crisis. We need to build our way out of it. Now, that is the growth metric talking. It's not a rational response at all. You know, we don't have the carbon for that. We should just reallocate houses and retrofit them a lot more carefully. This would be a much better way to go. It's the financialization of the housing markets that are driving that growth. It's not
absolutely
anything else, right? So once you take the population off the table to some extent, at some point you start leveling out here. And again, even many African countries are leveling out by mid of the century and then towards the end. So Africa's a very young continent and hugely variable, but generally very young compared to the others. And even that stuff levels out. So we're talking about fewer people around. You don't see this anywhere. I look at the growth projections for Melbourne, where I am. It's supposed to be like 11 million by 2050 or something, or 2055. It's like, these are just made up numbers, not looking at any of this other stuff. Like, where are those people coming from? Like, all the growth here is migration led, great. But then when you start taking the overall number of people in the world, that starts flattening out. Yes, we'll see urbanization, but like not everywhere. It can't be. There's just not enough people. You know, sort of. So this is why I'm doing a lot of research in Japan at the minute about sort of empty houses and some of these regionals. And it's so interesting because once you take house prices down to zero because they're empty, interesting things start happening. And there are beginning to be, the second book now comes in called Slow Down, called by Kohei Saito, who's a Japanese philosopher. He wrote this book 2 years ago in Japan, became a surprise bestseller. And it's basically, I don't fully subscribe to the language personally, but because I grew up in the 80s, but he calls it communist degrowth. Now, what he really means by that is commons and communing, which you would have heard a lot of people talking about, including wasn't my friend Indy. So commonly owned goods, you know, one way or another. I think in a way he's not going to get away with these words in the States or the UK. You can't talk about communism because of history. But if you talked about commoning or commonly owned goods and assets, that's what he's hedging towards there. And he says, if we slow down our economy to this more organic growth level, again, based on the fact that we don't really need to grow it, actually, we can achieve welfare for everybody without having to push GDP upwards, then you end up with this far more interesting, complex situation. And that's beginning to happen in what I saw in Japan in Kagoshima in December, I think. I can't read it very well because I'm not Japanese, but it's like this, in interviewing people there, looking around, I can see people beginning to lash together different social structures in these towns of like 40,000, 50,000 in regional Japan that are based on local food loops and farmers working with schools and school kids learning how to make tofu and stuff, and then the food waste from the school going back to the farmers. And there is sort of, you know, these kind of little circular loops beginning to emerge because the buildings are now becoming almost free, not quite, but almost, and because they're never going to be gentrified because there's not the population numbers. And so they're beginning to look like, it's just like emerging sort of weak signals, you'd say, from a foresight point of view of something else. And it's not great necessarily, as Saito points out, because the Japanese government, meanwhile, is still in full-on like GDP growth mode. So we kind of have like two engines running simultaneously in different directions now. That's just going to shear itself apart. Not good. What Saito says is we shouldn't look at the population decline in Japan as any kind of hope here, you know, unless we reframe what we think of ourselves as a society and what we're doing. But you're looking at somewhere where, in Dorling's book, coming back to him, he says, maybe we work a bit less. Maybe we do 4-day weeks. You know, maybe in the US, I think you work 47 hours a week on average. That's insane, by the way. But anyway, if you came back down to like 27.
Everything here is insane.
I know, like 32 hours, and it's kind of appealing. You can do other things. That you have time then for this kind of communal activity. You can have time for other things in that sense. That's where Dorling goes. He's a bit dismissive of Saito. Saito kind of goes full on into, you know, he's a Marxist scholar, so he heads that way. But But either way, you're beginning to see, as Jason Hickles, the publisher, has all of this builds on what by Ostrom and other things. My colleague Mariana Mazzucato has a new book out about the common good. You know, like there's all these big things beginning to swill around here, which are living within a certain material footprint, still producing, creating, exchanging, still movement, still cultures interacting, all of those things, but without the kind of growth imperative underneath it. So it looks like a slowing down. But back to where I started this very long answer, it might also still have fashion and things within it, you know, moments of fast culture popping up because maybe there's even more time for culture. But it, you know, so you still have these different layers of change going on.
I think that's the promise, right? That within these spaces, there's movement, which kind of brings us kind of back maybe to our middle that, you know, culture moves slower than people think, but sometimes it moves faster. And even volcanic flows are like this, right? You have the moment when the volcano erupts, very fiery and everything moves, but then you have those like really glacial, slow lava flows where it looks like almost like it's not moving at all, but it is, right? And both those states exist in the same geographic and geological entity, right? And I think this conversation and many others and the people we cited show that there's many different ways in which this stuff is kind of ebbing and flowing, right? Which is why I was really excited to have this hodgepodge, right? Because it allowed us to kind of touch on so many different things. I want to get to the final two segments of the show in the time we have left. And the first one is Off the Dome, which is just a rapid fire question. First comes to mind, and this is going to be an easy one. Maybe it won't be. Man City.
I haven't had a coffee yet. So like, ask me again.
Man U or Man City?
Oh my God. That is not. No, they're both terrible.
Oh, what's your team?
I support Liverpool. So this is like,
we are best friends, my friend.
Oh, really? Oh, there we go. Amazing. You know, India is a Liverpool supporter as well.
The entire season hinges on this weekend.
Pretty much. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's a decision I made because when I was about 7 years old, and it's one of those decisions the only decision you make when you're seven, more or less, I think. Although sometimes I think I'm increasingly like I was when I was seven. Yeah. but anyway.
We're regressing.
Yeah, no, the Liverpool. So I hate Man United and Man City equally.
And this past weekend, I have a really good friend who's a Liverpool fanatic. And I was like, dude, Man, he hates Man U more than Man City. Because, you know, for a long time, Man City wasn't.
That's the historical hatred.
So historically, he hates Man U. And I was like, dude, you got to root for him today. It's better for Man U to have won last weekend than for Man City. And they didn't pull it off. 3-1.
No, so, relying on Man United right now is like, relying on GDP growth and a declining population base. It's like, it's not a good horse to bet on.
It's not a good mix. Well, my friend, I'm gonna get to the drop right now. I only have one question. I figured it was gonna be one or the other. I'm even better answer that it's neither. And yeah, it's even though I do love Pep. Pep is he's a leader of men.
Yeah, and I wrote a book like 2 years ago, both in my Swedish work, and I managed to slip in a reference to both Pep and Jurgen Klopp. This is like a book published by the Swedish government about innovation. And so
both of them are phenomenal leaders.
Exactly. Amazing. And Klopp, by the way, also I think is one of the other things I talked about in Japan when I gave this talk was about 21st century leadership. And there's quite a lot of that goes on with Klopp, I think, about his use of or his deference to a wider team of people. He's very quick to say, like, I just surrounded myself with smart people, for instance. He kind of plays that down a lot. Yeah. And there's a sort of arrogance, clearly, because you wouldn't be that way if you weren't a bit, but also there's a humbleness and there's a care thing going on, as well as an astute tactical brain. You know, there's like a lot of...
Yeah. There's a lot of really good things.
Completely. Even the team being a collective, you know, sort of, it's more of a system, but then it still has room for individual creativity within it. So you still have like any football team, but or an orchestra or whatever. Like I love these, or a good kitchen. You know, there's context where you have you have, it comes together from a collective, like a symbiotic kind of sense of almost like a commons again, but you still have room for improvisation. Yeah. Or interpretation, and so
we can, I'm fascinated by could it. Do an entire conversation just on football.
Yeah, and, another time, man.
And
yeah,
the leadership. Like. So we're gonna have to do a part two that's solely on that. I want to get to the drop, and the drop is just an opportunity to share anything at all with our listeners. And you've peppered in quite a few references throughout the course of the conversation of some books and things. So I feel like this is a drop heavy episode, just in a very organic way, which is wonderful. My drop is actually a new show that started here. This is the second week. It's called Shogun, which is based off of a book.
Yeah.
And it's also
the first half of the first episode. Yeah.
Yeah. It's really good. It's on FX Hulu. And I remember the original Shogun when I was a kid that came out like in 1980. I didn't really watch it because I was like, I don't want to watch this. But I remember it being on in the house. This is the days when there's one TV. So whether or not you went, and there's one TV and there were like five channels. So whatever your parents were watching, you were watching too. So I do remember the original, but it didn't quite catch my attention in the same way. Other, like I remember Winds of War and The Day After and Roots. Those were big for me. Shogun wasn't, but this one is really amazing so far. It's only three episodes in at the time we're recording it. Likely by the time this is released, it might be halfway through or maybe even over, but that's my drop to check out. The new version of Shogun on FX/Hulu. So
yeah, that's it was immediately compelling. It just had that kind of like Apple TV level sheen to it.
Oh yeah, and, definitely.
It's like it's, beautiful, and
they put some attention into that. Attention they did, and care.
Yeah. It's another completely. I think that I also watched that James Clavell's Shogun, right? Wasn't it? The one in the '80s. I remember that one too. Yeah.
Richard Chamberlain.
So the thing, maybe weirdly, I am watching a TV show at the minute, a Finnish TV show called The Man Who Died, which is strangely appealing to me, but it might be to literally nobody listening. So I'll say something else as well. But because it has this very kind of quirky Finnish sort of backdrop to it, it's about a mushroom entrepreneur and who sells Finnish mushrooms to Japan. And there's a subplot about his wife poisoning him and so on and so on, and to the man who died. So that's really beautiful and lovely, but you, unless you've been to Finland, you might think, what on earth is this strange place? So the other, just quickly then, I just finished the book Amitav Ghosh, Smoke and Ashes. It's epic. It's amazing. It's so good. And, you know, growing up in England, when I went to school, I'm like 53 years old, so it was like at school in the 80s, I guess, early 80s. What we learned about the emperor was horrifyingly small and narrow. And I just went to a normal, like, public school, comprehensive school, state school, right? So it was just the national curriculum. And the Industrial Revolution was all of this great British invention, you know, one after another, scientific geniuses and so on and so on. And then great entrepreneurs. And of course, none of that is true. And so Amitav Ghosh's book, Smoke and Ashes, is the story of opium. And it's the story of how opium is at the heart of basically the British Empire, the whole thing, and most of America's early days as well. So it's kind of fascinating. It's a beautiful book, beautifully written, because he's an amazing writer. And it just goes through the, everything is in there. You know, like he describes the poppy as a kind of the non-human actor actually driving human history, you know, with intent, sort of exploiting humans' worst proclivities to kind of propagate itself, which is kind of a fascinating thing. And he says, historians don't have words for non-human actors. You know, it's usually this great man or this great woman, usually man. So but in this case, the poppy is like in the background there. And then they obviously forcing India into a completely different thing that it was through basically force, and then coercing China to be a customer of India again through opium wars and gunboats. So all of the British Empire based on really just advanced military rather than advanced science and technology, and just really brutal acts at global scale. So it's amazing. And he just goes through all of that, and he goes through to the States, and of course he talks about how the British Empire kind of hid the opium trade from sight in a very British way, I would say. And so it wasn't really as obvious. In America, it was not as hidden, you know, in the early days. And So he talks about the Delano family, which is where, you know, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, that was originally an opium family. Forbes, heavily involved in opium. Like all of these names around you now, like Peabody, like, you know.
And here we are again.
All linked
in
to the
opium. In the middle of a opioid crisis, right?
Well, that's where he ends up, yeah. So he ends up kind of basically talking about this, the opioid crisis evolving again into Purdue and what's happened down in the States recently. And so it's this most incredible book through this broad sweep of history. He's writing as an Indian writer, wondering originally about the relationship with China and why it wasn't so clear. And then he realizes he's sitting in his living room in Mumbai, like drinking from China, as in for porcelain. He's drinking tea, which is Chinese. You know, it's like he's surrounded by it. And then from that, he just, it's beautifully researched. It's incredibly well, you know, cited, but it's written as by an author who can write fiction as well as he writes nonfiction. So it like
which
runs at a clip, and it's just, yeah, it's so good. Anyway.
No, that's a fantastic drop.
Hefty drop.
No, I'll take hefty drops are allowed on the deep dive. I mean, Dan, this is, it's been a long time coming, but I'm glad we were able to make this from my present to the future to have this conversation. It's everything I could have asked for and more, and I really can't wait for this one to come out. But I really want to thank you for joining me on the deep dive and starting your day with me.
No, thanks so much, Philip. It's so nice to be asked by you, because as I said, I've been listening to you for years, and I love the way you curate the guests, but then you host such generous kind of freewheeling conversations. Like, I like hodgepodge. I might try and say that 5 times today. Kind of slip it in there. It's so good.
Sneak peek is going to be the title of this episode.
No, thanks so much.
It's hodgepodge in the best way. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Pleasure. Thank you.
You can listen to The Deep Dive via Apple Podcasts and our website, thedeepdivepod.com. Download, subscribe, listen, and share. If you like what you're hearing and enjoy what me and the team are putting together, then leave us a review. We'd love to hear from you. You can follow me on Twitter via @farflungphil. To all my listeners, wherever you are in the world, I thank you. See you on the other side.